Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. We are back. Another week, we live to tell the tale. I'm Emily Jane Fox. I'm here with my co-host, Joe Hagan. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Emily Jane Fox. It's a pleasure to be back here with all the people.
Always. Guys, it seems like you loved last week's episode. We're so excited. I loved it too. Joe, I think you loved it. So fun.
Loved it.
We'll be sure to keep having conversations like that one. It was so important. I think it will continue to be so important. And we will keep bringing you that kind of guest, that kind of conversation. But thanks
for tuning in. That was Mara Healy, the Attorney General for Massachusetts, talking about the prospect of indicting soon-to-be former President Donald Trump, who seems to be, he'll be the last to know that he's the former president, it appears. But yeah, that was an amazing interview you did last week. The people seem to love it, and we'll be bringing you more of that, of course, in the coming months. Now, you know, there was an article sometime this week talking about, you know, the sort of different views of what is going on in the country between Trump and Joe Biden. And Biden is saying, hey, it's going to be a dark winter. He's saying we need to get real here. And Trump's still living in a fantasy land. And, it sort of brought to mind, speaking of guests, we have Rick Perlstein, the author of a fantastic book called Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. We have him on the show today, and he's going to be talking about the book's really about the birth of the right wing that we have all come to know over the last many years, how it came about in the after the ashes of Watergate and the collapse really of Jimmy Carter's presidency, and how it was built, the blueprint for it. And one of the things that you find, and we all know, is that you know, there was a view, a Reagan comes smiling, Ronald Reagan of California, you know, puts a happy smiling face on this sort of you know, kind of Scrooge-like economic policy that he's going to deliver to the world, and that will define really the conservative Republican politics for the next 50 years. And one of the things that Jimmy Carter suffered from was this idea that he represented malaise, that he wasn't optimistic, he was asking the country to sacrifice. You know, these were words he used. He gave the malaise speech that became sort of famous or infamous moment in his presidency. And it brought to mind all of the problems that Joe Biden could have when he becomes president. You know, the cautionary tales of somebody who comes in promising to kind of unite the country, reset things after a period of chaos. In the 70s case, we're talking about Watergate and Nixon and all that brought on. And now we have this. And, you know, what can we learn from history and present to this president-elect Joe Biden as, hey, let's think about restoring certain aspects of our political conversation and our culture but the country also kind of fundamentally has a bad reaction to people who are too, you know, dark, right? And it made me, I remember when I heard the expression, you know, it's going to be a dark winter, which is a real thing, and we need to pay attention to this pandemic. It also gave me a little quiver, having read all of this stuff about Jimmy Carter and the things that, the kind of self-inflicted wounds that he gave to himself politically, and how the press, you know, coming out of Watergate, the press, you know, the ones that, that sort of birthed the kind of journalism that you and I have practiced our whole careers, that same press, they were very hard on Jimmy Carter. And any kind of minor gaffe that happened, they all glommed onto because they were just looking for a story. And everybody, if there was any smoke, right, they thought there must be a fire because we had just come out of Watergate, right? And now we're just coming out of Trump, where it's just been like an immense amount of news, and the press will want more of that. Well, anyway, all of that is a long-winded way of saying that Rick Perlstein is going to, in this interview that I'm about to do, talk about some of this. And it's a fantastic interview. It's a deep dive of the kind that I think we'll find immensely pleasurable, and especially for people that, you know, kind of love both history, but also sort of the retro pleasures of a guy who can bring its novelistic drama out of it. If you were a fan of Mad Men or Mrs. America, this is the book for you, because it takes you to the newspaper level, the day-by-day, blow-by-blow drama of what happened in the late 70s and how it all emerged to be the history we know.
It really feels like the perfect way to historically situate the moment that we're in and perhaps give us a little bit of an understanding of what President Joe Biden is in for in terms of the press. The situation you just laid out just feels so exact mm-hmm. to what we could be about to face. And I think, look, the language is, it is dark. It is gloomy. It certainly matches the times we're in. And that's certainly, no one really wants a reminder of just how bleak it is, right? Everyone knows how bleak it is. What they're looking for is morning in America, right? But mm-hmm. I think, while I understand the idea that people don't want to hang around in that gloom, there's something about it that I like. And I'll tell you why. I think that we have lived in this era for the last 5 years that is so devoid of any tie to reality that mm-hmm. if this is just a sign that, like, what our highest leader is going to be like in terms of trying to ground us back in reality, even if it's not what you want to hear, we are in for a dark winter. We have mm-hmm. we have people dying at such alarming rates every single way. To make that sound optimistic would be untrue.
And I'm not suggesting he do that at all. And I, you know, yeah, we broke a record this week, 3,000 people in one day. You know,
it's more than on 9/11.
Dying. Yeah. So this is all of which is to say there's no perfect analogy to be made here. And also, and by the way, there's the darkness of this reality we're facing, and there's the darkness of what the right wing is curdling into in the face of it, in the face of this loss. You had Rush Limbaugh saying this week, you know, we're trending towards secession, right? I see more and more people asking, what in the world do we have in common with the people who live in, say, New York? I just thought, what are you talking about? I mean, that's madness. This is a world of madness is sort of evolving on the right. You don't know if it's evolving or if it's, this is the sort of like the last throes of a kind of insane lunatic fringe, you know, party. We hope it is, right? But once again, all of this sort of born out of trends that have been with us all along, right? And it makes you realize the degree to which Trump sort of unwrapped, he sort of gave us the blunt end of all these things that had been kind of bubbling under the surface of our culture for years.
Sure.
And now we have to figure out how to mediate them again.
That's exactly right. That's why I'm so excited to hear this interview, because I think it really just puts all of what we are about to go through to witness into a little bit of context. And I know you guys get into it. So let's just get right to it.
Mr. Rick Perlstein, author of Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980. Hi, how are you?
Joe, I'm doing well.
I'm really psyched to have you on the program. I'm a big fan of your work. Nixonland, I have a copy of your book, Nixonland, with full of yellow post-it notes, which I used that book. It was a reference. It was for my book, Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner in Rolling Stone magazine. It was in the bibliography. And so you and I sort of traced some similar, historical pathways, the 60s and 70s in particular. And I really admire what you've done, especially with this latest one, Reaganland, which is kind of like this really propulsive, novelistic, front row seat to the kind of blow by blow of how, the rise of Reagan in the late 70s. It's kind of a blueprint for really the right wing as we would come to know it, right, in the last 50 years. And one of the things I was really fascinated with reading about you was that, in terms of how you got interested in all this, before we dive into the book, there was a bookstore in Milwaukee where you're from.
That's right.
Right, that had kind of like, stacks of old magazines, and you discovered
them.
Yeah, tell me about that.
The Renaissance Bookstore. It was kind of like one step ahead of the building inspector. And I think finally it was condemned, but only like, 5 or 6 years ago. And it was just a stupendous place. I mean, it was like something out of like, you go to in a movie where you go and like go and then the next scene is, like gremlins are infesting the earth, strange and exotic and weird and musty and, really fit the kind of my Baroque sense, I think, of the history of this, strange nation of ours. It was very memorable. I must have been like, 16 or 17, 18, before I packed off to college. And I specifically remember articles that I would look up, for my research for Reaganland. Turns out that, my gift in life was remembering things I read in magazines, 30 years earlier.
Right. And there's something kind of magical about coming across like a stack of old magazines in an antique store or something, and you start flipping through and it's like, wow, it's always remarkable.
That's my jam, really.
That's your jam for sure. And one of the wonderful things about your books, which take you through the political history in a way that will edify you as great books of history will, but also incredibly entertaining because of the little details from newspapers and magazines.
That's a philosophy I have, that basically people live their lives with no hard and fast distinctions between what's politics and what's culture, what's the economy, what's family. It's all kind of mixed together. And that's what I try and convey, that kind of thickness of the passage of time.
Yeah.
So I got to talk about movies. I got to talk about newspapers. I got to talk about, your mom going off to work because your dad, his income is stagnating. And next thing feminism is happening. And the next thing after that, Phyllis Schlafly is, coming hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all connected.
As a child of the 70s, this was a little, right. It's almost like reading your book is a little bit like finding out what the adults were doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's really funny. There was like, when I wrote my last one's called Invisible Bridge, and it covers 1973 to 1976. And I mentioned in there, I think I mentioned it, that in a kindergarten class was having an impassioned debate about the big issue of the day, which was whether, and I made people think it was, Gerald Ford pardoning Richard Nixon, but it was something that happened the same day, which was Evel Knievel trying to jump the Snake River Canyon. And there was a huge debate in my kindergarten class among all the dudes about whether he pulled his parachute on purpose because he chickened out. So you get into the realm where I can kind of remember this stuff.
Yeah, it's certain that I was in a similar debate somewhere else in America at the time. Because of that.
Where'd you come down?
On whether he had a parachute?
Yeah. Well, he had a parachute, but whether he did it on purpose.
You know, I don't remember this specifically, but I did have the Evel Knievel toy,
yeah,
which you wound up.
Yeah, I had
up
that one too. You wound it up. Yeah. And of course, the point is that people had this unbelievable, insatiable appetite in the early 70s, you know, for basically TV shows that were like snuff films, in which like, you basically watched to see if Evel Knievel was going to die or not, which kind of paralleled the fate of the Republic.
Totally. And, you know, we get the expression jumping the shark from the Happy Days episode, in which Fonzie is attempting to do an Evel Knievel-like stunt.
Right. And I grew up in Milwaukee, so, you know, Evel Knievel, we had Fonzie Day in the same kindergarten class.
Right. And we just lost David Lander, a.k.a. Squiggy, recently, which is a, you know, cultural touchstone for many of us. So we're aging ourselves rapidly here on this podcast.
Yeah.
But, to give people a sense, you know, people often say newspapers, the news is like the first draft of history. And one of the things I love about your books is that you take us back to that first draft to show, you know, how many... kind of
how crappy they are as historians.
well, that and also that we have all these received wisdoms about what happened. But when you go back and look at the details, it's much richer than you have been led to believe in many ways. And then there's just the fun nuggets of information, two of my favorites of which are that Jimmy Carter sat in with Dizzy Gillespie and sang Salt Peanuts.
Right. And then bragged about it in his diary about how Dizzy Gillespie the New York Times praised his singing voice.
Which is amazing. And then the other one was that Muhammad Ali offered to trade himself for the American hostages during the Iran.
Yes, I just reread that part, actually.
Yeah.
That was during a full on blood soaked riot in which, you know, like Iranian students were beaten within an inch of their lives by a multicultural group of Americans on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills.
Insane. That whole scene was just insane. I mean, and really crazily, so much of what you write about, like things like that, they just sort of presage. You just realize that what we're seeing today with Donald Trump has all just been with us the entire time. And a lot of the outlines of the conversations we've been having in the last, whatever, you know, 10, 20, 15 years are the same ones we were having, but they were established. A lot of them were established during the period that you write about here.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it.
So I, you know, one of the things I really hone in on in this book, when it opens up, it's, you know, basically Jimmy Carter is coming into office. You know, the Republican Party is in shambles after Watergate. And Jimmy Carter has like an 80% approval rating.
Yep.
Right.
He's Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I mean, what was the sort of promise of Jimmy Carter?
Or a 70s singer-songwriter. I kind of stole this from an Associated Press writer who pointed out to me recently that Jimmy Carter kind of culturally was presented to the nation in 1976, kind of like a 1970s singer-songwriter.
Yeah. Wow.
In a flannel shirt.
Sure.
Who promised, you know, absolute earnest honesty, you know, about his relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, just kind of like would just kind of like cut the throat of kind of the bloated kind of dinosaur rock, you know, that had become American politics, to put it in a Rolling Stone Argo, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
But, you know, just to kind of pay out the metaphor, of course, you know, the ultimate, you know, kind of honest, decent, you know, redemptive singer-songwriter of the 70s, John Denver, comes in for it in the course of the story when it turns out in 1979 during the fuel shortage, he'd been secretly storing hundreds of gallons of petroleum beneath his mountain estate, right?
Amazing.
Which makes him kind of a villain of the energy crisis. So yes, we're seeking innocence, right?
Yeah.
And there is no innocence to be had, right? The idea that we can kind of redeem America through, you know, his promises, I will never lie to you. And, you know, he lies a lot less than other presidents, but, you know, that it really isn't enough. Any president, you know, if Ronald Reagan had managed to beat Gerald Ford in 1976, we wouldn't remember this as the age of Reagan. We might remember, you know, Ronald Reagan as this, you know, pathetic failure like Jimmy Carter. You know, I mean, a lot of this was bad timing, but a lot of it also was Jimmy Carter really ran on, I've called it a bait and switch operation. I'm not sure that's really fair, but it was a very vague campaign, right? It was. I mean, in Invisible Bridge, my previous book, I compare it to the presidential candidate in Nashville, who's never seen and just kind of makes all these kind of vague, you know, kind of pleasant sounding promises over a sound truck while driving through Nashville. And that's a little bit what what Jimmy Carter did when he was asked to be specific about his policy positions. He tried something you can't really get away with as well now, which you say, oh, well, I'll spell them those out after I'm elected, basically.
Yeah.
So no one really knew what he was going to do, but they liked who he was, really. And, you know, that he came off as a seasoned person. But it turns out that he had a very specific agenda in mind, and that he really craved the idea of calling the nation to sacrifice.
Right.
And saying, you know, we've kind of lived too well, and now we've got to cut our belts and rein it in, which made him a pretty vulnerable foil to Ronald Reagan's message, which of course was, America's the greatest nation on the earth. How dare you say we have to change anything?
Yeah.
And, you know, so Jimmy Carter all along is basically delivering the old right-wing conservative measure about what we need to do about financial problems, inflation, high employment. The government has to tighten its belts. And this is exactly the time that the Republicans, very cynically, and very dubiously, are coming up with this idea that if we just cut taxes for everybody, we'll achieve this biblical miracle of the loaves and fishes. And not only will, you know, everyone have more money in their pocket, which used to be the Democrats' promise, the New Deal promise, that the government is going to help you have more money for yourself. Not only is everyone going to get more money because taxes are going to be lower, the government won't even have to sacrifice anything because the revenues will go up so much because the economy will boom like a skyrocket.
Right.
Of course, it was a complete fiction. The best description of it was, you know, uttered by Ronald Reagan's rival for the 1980 nomination, George H.W. Bush, who calls it voodoo economics.
Right. And this is the trickle-down. The trickle-down concept is born. Right.
Yes.
This is Inside the Hive.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarsella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarsella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
Interestingly, you know, while you're sort of tracking the Jimmy Carter presidency, which is like kind of rife with both self-inflicted and sort of fatalistic events that conspire to, you know, ruin his approval rating, you have, you know, appropriately, almost like Jaws, you have this fin coming at him. In the form of Reagan, who's sort of, you know, behind the scenes or under the water most of the time.
Well, it's Jaws, too, because, you know, Jaws came out in 75. And that was another thing. That was a little detail that I have. Like, Hollywood was so desperate for steady blockbuster profits. All they did was sequels now. So we'll call it Jaws 2.
Yeah, Jaws 2. Okay, that's good. I like that. Jaws 2.
Just when you thought it was safe to get back in the water. You remember
exactly.
That
exactly. But he's you sort of say that what he ends up kind of putting together is a political strategy of quote unquote organized discontent.
That's right.
And I thought that was really interesting because what you have is we mentioned Phyllis Schlafly, who's going against the ERA and feminism, and then you've got Anita Bryant, this other kind of forgotten figure who was like the anti-gay rights.
I hope no one forgets Anita Bryant, man.
Yeah,
Google
well,
that, kids.
We're just trying to forget her music, but but you know, there's all these kind of, and then you've got the kind of backlash against the business, the corporate interests.
Yes.
And so all of these little kind of cross currents that are happening, and Reagan is kind of beginning to stitch them together, as it were, right?
That's right. He's a coalition builder, like all great politicians.
Yeah. And a lot of it is like coming in, is it kind of too simplistic to say that a lot of this is kind of the slow reaction to the 60s cultural upheaval, right?
I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
What happens is, when I talk about the Renaissance bookstore, right? The 60s, basically you had a revolution happening like every week. The difference between 1964 and 1969 is just like night and day. Maybe we can kind of feel this now with Trump, but in a different kind of way. But like the difference between like 2015 and 2010, they were the same. But 1968, 1969, it just was such a melodramatic time, and kind of, one of the melodramas was this extraordinary outpouring of insurgent energy. And what happens in the 1970s is it begins kind of working its way through the institutions of society. And, it's feminists are, radical lunatics, when they kind of, in the perception of the world, when they kind of burst onto the scene in the late 1960s. But I quote, when women are the men of the year are American women, in Time Magazine's Man of the Year in 1976. And they're basically like, well, everyone's a feminist now. Everyone agrees, the ERA is about to pass, And one of the points I make in all my books is that it's when kind of liberal ideas are on the cusp of becoming completely hegemonic and in the mainstream, when liberals get most confident that they're inevitable, that the most dangerous backlash tends to ensue, because, change is hard. And people who are of conservative temperament, freak out when change comes. And again and again in the book, I have that, it's almost like a trope of mine. I quote Randy Schiltz, the kind of biographer of Harvey Milk, saying 1977 was going to be the year of the gay, after pointing out, all these states that were passing gay rights laws, all these municipalities. And then, lo and behold, the shark kind of crashes to the surface of the water.
Yeah.
And it's actually to kind of extend that metaphor, Phyllis Schlafly says in her 1964, million zillion selling book for Barry Goldwater, A Choice Not an Echo, that politics is 7/8%. Seven eighths below the surface of the water, right? So, I literally do use the metaphor from icebergs kind of crashing to the surface that had previously been invisible, because lo and behold, it turns out that these housewives have been quietly, sedulously, brilliantly organizing against the Equal Rights Amendment all along, that not only did they not consider feminism inevitable, they considered it a threat to their very being. Literally, it was going to keep Jesus from coming back to earth. And I quote these books that sell millions of copies that suddenly, Time Magazine isn't noticing, in which literally, 5 million copies are being sold of books that say the key to happiness for women is to submit themselves to their husband like they submit themselves to God.
Yeah.
And, that's out there. And, how are you going to turn that into a vehicle for electoral politics? Well, that's the story of the book.
Right. And just to your book has these beautiful color images inside of some of these books. The Spirit Controlled Woman by Beverly LaHaye, right?
Whose husband wrote Left Behind, right?
That's right. Yeah. And
they wrote a sex manual. So one of the things that's happening with these groups is that they're kind of this is, kind of what happens to insurgencies. They're kind of domesticated. So the Christian right is kind of adopting all the things that and kind of under their own kind of agenda, right? So Beverly LaHaye and Tim LaHaye write a sex manual for Christians that argues that it is the duty of every Christian husband to give their wife orgasms. And that God, my wife just walked in and giggled. not just Christian women, Christian men. And that, you know, the clitoris was put there for a purpose. And they literally explain how a man is to stimulate his wife's clitoris manually by quoting something in the book of Ecclesiastes.
Yeah, I remember this in the book and kind of my eyes popping out. I mean, and it's in keeping with the general gestalt of the 70s, right?
It's supposed to be the thing that pops. So.
Yeah. That's like, but the, it was still very 70s. It was just on the right wing side.
But just enough that kind of like, you know, it used to be that fundamentalists were kind of like in this bubble and couldn't enjoy the things that modern life have to offer. So you get the good stuff, but you're able to kind of protest against the stuff that you consider, you know, basically satanic.
Right. So this is one of the many cultural currents that are happening, and that different kind of newsletter writers and male kind of organizers.
Again, beneath the surface of what the mainstream media is noticing.
Yeah, and people are really doing some real organizing and getting big databases together, basically, of like, they're out there. These people are out there. They're working class people. They're religious people, people in the South, people that, you know, Jimmy Carter might have been able to connect with at first because he was seen as a Baptist from the South and had some things they could identify with. But essentially, he kind of
for gay rights.
Right. And other things. Right. So and I don't know. And essentially feminism, too. Right.
Yes. He sold out lots of liberal constituencies and activist groups over and over again, at all kinds of stuff. He sold out labor. You know, he sold out the abortion movement, but he never sold out the ERA. He was four square for that.
Right. And he kind of gives this. This is sort of tangentially related, but he gives this famous interview to Playboy magazine in which he admits he has.
That's what first kind of raises the alarm of the Christians. Yeah.
Right. That he has lust in his heart. He has lusted in his heart.
Even though he's really explaining Christian theology in a very clear way about why he's not a sinner for actually having these thoughts because he asked for forgiveness. But anyway, it's enough. It shows that, you know, the people who are claiming to be the, you know, sort of the followers of the Prince of Peace aren't quite what they say they are. Which, you know.
So that puts Jimmy Carter in kind of like you have a great little line in here. I'm going to paraphrase it, but basically that he had promised so much, or there had been so much ways in which he was trying to promise a lot when he ran.
Right.
That
all when things to all people.
Yeah. When the bill came due for, you know, then bill came due for his ideological profligacy, as you put
that's
it.
That's the one. Yeah, that's right.
It's a great line.
There's this great scene where, like, basically it's literally in Dick Cheney's office where they're kind of planning the 1976 campaign for Gerald Ford, and their pollster is giving a presentation, and he's basically using these clear plastic sheets in which he's plotted the support of Jimmy Carter by all these constituencies. He's placing one over the other, and they're all kind of like clustered around Jimmy Carter, and like they're like, oh my god, how do we beat this guy? Everyone loves him, even if their politics are completely contrasted to one another. So that really kind of explains, you know, why we remember kind of Jimmy Carter as such a failure, because he couldn't possibly please all these constituencies.
Right, and he had, of course, on the left, that left an opening for, and this is some of the most amazing, fascinating history that I knew about but hadn't explored as deeply as I did when I read your book about Ted Kennedy's rise on the left.
Totally, you know,
he kind of creates an opening for Ted Kennedy, of course, who has so many issues and kind of becomes a deer in the headlights.
He does, you know, and he has all those issues. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Chappaquiddick and his wife is, they're basically on the verge of divorce. Right. And yet, at the same time, Ted Kennedy, even after literally, he kind of pulls, I hate to say this, but he kind of pulls a Donald Trump. I mean, he refuses to take no for an answer after he loses the nomination at the convention. By the way, he goes all the way to the convention.
Wow.
He is given time to give a speech during a platform debate and gives what I call the most effective anti-Jimmy Carter speech of the entire campaign given by anyone, Republican or Democrat. You know, after spending all spring and summer running commercials in which, you know, Carol O'Connor, who plays, again, getting back to popular culture, who plays Archie Bunker, this blue-collar guy, says that if Jimmy Carter is elected, there'll be a worse depression than under Herbert Hoover. I mean, that is not a united Democratic Party right there.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, and so then, you know, he has a right wing that's getting organized, and Reagan... Yep. Prepared to claim the mantle. And on the left, he's got, you know, Ted Kennedy and kind of a lot of disappointed liberals. And then there's this other factor, which, you know, besides putting aside the cultural reaction, you also have what I had never really completely understood it until I read your book, the economic forces that were impacting the 70s. Now, people hear about the oil crisis and everything, but really the central issue was that the post-war economic boom had finally abated after years of like double-digit growth or whatever. You finally had this slowdown and the quote-unquote malaise that Carter suddenly inherits.
And coming in this context in which basically people believe that America is going to be the dominant economic force like forever.
Right.
Nothing can stop it.
That's right. And so that inevitability suddenly has hit a wall. You've had Nixon has, you know, you've had an impeached president and a huge scandal. Yeah. And the other thing I would point out, because there are so many, you know, there's a galaxy of different trends here, but one that fascinates me being a guy in the media is that post-Watergate, the media became more aggressive. And more shallow in some weird ways, like they would just hop onto Carter over any little gaffe. And like we mentioned, the Playboy interview, which was a really rich, in-depth, thoughtful interview. But everybody found this one dumb thing that he said, and it became a huge scandal.
Exactly. You know, everyone wants to be Woodward and Bernstein. And there are all kinds of kind of these kind of pseudo scandals that kind of rise to the level of scandals. It really kind of, and that really informs, you know, we talk about the stuff in this book that really helps us understand the archaeology of how we got to the way we are now.
Yeah.
You really see this gathering force of both sides journalism where, you know, literally, you know, Reagan scandals get like almost no coverage, and Carter's, you know, pseudo scandals get hyper coverage, partly because, you know, Washington is this insular little village and these guys don't play by the rules. They're a bunch of yokels, you know, that's the Snopes clan in Washington. It's the cast of Gone with the Wind. It's these guys who wear cowboy boots and jean jackets at the White House.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't go to the cotillions, you know, that Sally Quinn, you know, sets up, and they reap the whirlwind for that.
Right. Yeah. They're not sexy in the ways that the Georgetown set would like them to be, you know, like, and tasteful and scintillating. And,
but for a time, the public loves it. I mean, when I was a kid, we were driving to Disney World from Milwaukee for a vacation, and we stopped in Plains, Georgia, Carter's, hometown, which, you know, must have been after like his popularity faded, just thinking about when it was 79 or 80. And it was a tourist stop. We went to Billy Carter's gas station. You know, we ate peanut soup, you know.
Yeah.
It was redneck chic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, that's it's back CD to the plaid shirts and the, and, you know, it should be noted just this crosses over into my Rolling Stone history that, you know, there were fundraisers that Phil Waldman of Capricorn Records put together for him with the Allman Brothers.
And, it turns out Capricorn Records was like a drug front.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And it was all sort of, it's all very 70s, you know. But you had, you know, Bob Dylan was an advocate.
The Allman Brothers. Yeah.
Yeah. Hunter Thompson initially, you know, not exactly people you want on your side, but if you're trying to have a squeaky clean image, but
honestly, you know, that was the reason why they did the Playboy interview. It's like they thought they had evangelicals in the bag, but they didn't think they had this kind of hip cultural left in the bag. So that's why they, you know, did the Bob Dylan stuff. That's why they did, you know, it was kind of calculated.
Yeah, of course.
He was very good at faking sincerity. You know, I mean,
right.
He had a very good ad man who was kind of creating that image of the flannel shirt guy.
Right. And he was, you know, the boomers who were now in their 20s and moving into the 30s in some cases were the new, you know, they were a new lobby in a way. They were a new voting block that had to be dealt with, right? And this was the sort of interface was rock music.
This is Inside the Hive.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Let's talk about, you know, Reagan, before he becomes fully formed and is the president. And
right.
He was saying he had a lot of kooky ideas.
Didn't he, though?
I mean, you know, you pull a lot of quotes from things he said in speeches and in newspapers and stuff. And, you know, he was kind of fringy in some ways.
Yeah, a big part of what your job was if you were a Ronald Reagan staffer was to kind of hide Ronald Reagan's kookiness from the public.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, it was quite successful.
Right.
And that process, I think, it drives a lot of the drama in the book. A couple of weeks ago, one of the National Review Never Trumpers tweeted, you know, it's really important for the young generation to understand that, you know, like conservatism didn't always used to be kooks. It was, you know, what did he say? It was Krauthammer. It was blah, 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 Krauthammer and blah, 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 and Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And someone was like, what do you think of this, Rick? And I tweeted at the person who asked the question and also the guy who made the point. Well, how do you handle the fact that like a lot of the things that Ronald Reagan said were undeniably kooky?
Yeah.
You know, that like nuclear waste could be, you know, repurposed for industrial uses.
That's,
you
know, what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're talking about COVID. You know, he goes on the radio and says we should repeal the law that requires the FDA to approve the safety and effectiveness of drugs.
Right.
You know,
and
there's just a much bigger sense that like basically conservatism is great and it has its place. But, you know, and it's a great way to kind of, you know, kind of rouse the masses, you know, using all these kind of demagogy and kind of hatred of liberals and hatred of, you know, insurgent movements and the other and also racism. But,
sure.
You know, we want to keep our ass pretty tightly in Pandora's box to make sure it doesn't open too widely. You know, and a big part of, you know, what the contrast is between Reaganism and Trumpism is that sort of caution when it comes to the public face and the private face and the dog whistle and what you say, you know, to a New York Times columnist and what you say, you know, in a speech to an audience in Alabama, there's a wall between those things. And what Trump has done is he's kind of torn down the wall, which he couldn't have done, you know, without the groundwork being laid by Reaganism.
Right. He didn't have a Michael Deaver who was sort of like the Reagan whisperer.
Right. He fired Michael Deaver in, you know, like September of 2015, you know.
Right. You know, one of the things that I've thought a lot about reading your book, and there are no perfect historical analogies, but, you know, we've been talking about Jimmy Carter coming in with so much promise as a kind of, you know, a reset button, a reform, a restoration of some dignity and decency and all these things. And it sounds awfully familiar to one watching what's happening now.
Yeah. Well, when Democrats come in, there's always this kind of celebration that finally, you know, America's been returned to sanity. But, you know, America's kind of crazy.
Well, that's
and
the thing.
Insanity doesn't go away, you know.
The crazy doesn't go away. But do you, I was thinking about that this week because there was some article kind of contrasting Trump's kind of a reality-free, you know, view that things are going to be great and there's nothing wrong, nothing to see here. And by the way, I'm still president. Yeah. And then versus Biden saying, no, the winter, it's going to be a dark winter.
Right.
He's more realistic and yet also seems not optimistic. Right.
I think actually Biden's pretty good. I mean, who knows whether how successful he'll be. And, you know, he's obviously coming into strong cultural and political headwinds, you know, that we're talking about. But I think he's pretty good at kind of having that kind of saving remnant of Reaganite, you know, kind of optimism and America being great, but also a sort of kind of realism that any real mature, responsible leader has to have in the face of actual crises.
Yeah.
You know, I hope that he kind of strikes the balance, you know, usefully. But, you know, I would love to see Joe Biden, you know, being a little darker sometimes when it comes to, you know, you can never count out the America But I don't know. You know, maybe people like that stuff. And so as long as he doesn't kind of read his own press releases and buy it like Barack Obama did,
yeah,
you know, and kind of presume that, you know, if he's nice enough, he can somehow get the Republicans to like him.
Right.
You know, I think that's not a terrible way to start his administration.
Right. Well, he, you know, he doesn't enter with the same level of overripe expectation that Jimmy Carter had. Right.
He's, right. I think we're all chasing. And also, he doesn't have that kind of naivete.
Right.
You know, I mean, someone asked me, you know, he just did this thing where he nominated as his defense secretary a guy who's a 4-star general, which means he has to go to Congress and ask them to kind of basically temporarily moot the law that says that a civilian has to run the Pentagon. And, you know, a really smart analyst said, well, isn't that kind of like Jimmy Carter doing all these things to piss off Congress within the first couple of weeks or months of his administration? And I said, well, I would guess that Joe Biden, you know, has been in this game so long, he's kind of taking a calculated risk, as opposed to Jimmy Carter, who didn't even realize he was taking a risk. He
just right. assumed
that, you know, he had his mandate and Congress would go along with him. But all he did was, you know, sabotage the possibility of Congress having any kind of respect for what he was trying to accomplish.
Right. And one of the things that has to be noted, and this is a kind of an amazing thing, I'm reading your book where I'm set somewhere in 1978, maybe, and Joe Biden's actually in there, right? He had a front row seat.
With his finger in the wind.
Yeah, totally. And there's a whole scene where maybe, you know, I think Carter goes to him, and he relays a bunch of information to Carter. I can't remember exactly.
That's
what
this right.
is. Yeah.
He tells him that Ted Kennedy is going to run for president is the information.
That's a big piece of information. Yeah. Yeah. So, and every time a modern character comes into your book, it's kind of a fascinating thing, because when Reagan, for instance, is going to announce his presidency, having a big to-do in Manhattan, you know, you point out that this is the Manhattan of,
taxi driver.
Yeah, of taxi driver.
Yeah.
Yet there was this sort of resurgence among the real estate magnates.
Yes, he's rising.
Yeah, of which Mr. Donald Trump was one.
Mr. DJT is, yes, that's
yes.
his cameo.
Yes.
And the New York Times, you know, which is kind of, they've apologized for it, but they're basically marketing Donald J. Trump is just the tonic that New York City needs.
I saw, I read your book. I was like,
lies.
I thought,
you know, like he's driving the reporter around in his limousine, you know, and the reporter's like, oh, he has so many successful building projects going on.
Yeah, when I read that, I was like, oh, whoever that reporter, I mean, you were very kind, not to mention the byline.
Seriously, to the New York Times credit, when they did their big takeout on Trump's taxes like a year and a half ago or whatever, they quoted that article and they're like, we were wrong.
Right. Oh, good. Well, that's, it's pretty amazing. But I mean, it would have been hard to know what was coming around the, you know, and how much corruption had been there with he and his father in that business. Maybe it was something they could have investigated. But you know, as we mentioned at the outset, so much of what happens in your book, which is, I recommend to people listening to this. Being, you know, the holidays are coming. This is a profound, just in the heft and the size of it, somebody will feel like they have received something profound. It's a big book. But it really does, every time you're reading it, any section of it, you're either reminded of, a modern TV show that's riffing off of it, like Mrs. America, right? The Phyllis Schlafly thing, which I thought about a lot. And or the echoes in the news that just, and how fresh it feels to be reading about the Republicans, for instance, always being against having a voting holiday, for instance. they didn't want people to vote. Like, they didn't want it to be easy to vote. Right.
Yes, I have Ronald Reagan saying, literally, why don't we try to make it harder to vote?
Yes. And like, because they know that whatever they don't want the right people to vote. And that's exactly what is still happening now.
The Heritage Foundation says if we make voter registration more, you know, transparent and easy, it'll open up voting to 8 million illegal aliens.
Right. And well, and this, of course, is why Trump has tweeted out all year that, you know, if mail-in voting was, you know, everywhere, no Republicans would ever be, you know, elected again. I'm not sure that's true. But and then, you know, I was thinking about just this week, you know, Rush Limbaugh. I think it's on the Drudge Report as we speak here. But, you know, this idea of seceding, right, that the right should secede. I don't even, you know, how that would even happen. It's ridiculous. But he says, I see more and more people asking, what in the world do we have in common with people who live in, say, New York? Right. And this, you know, I guess this predates even your history and goes back to the Civil War. But,
right.
You know, this idea of this, the cultural fissures as they appear in your book, they haven't become as kind of Grand Canyon like as they are now. Right. I mean, there was still a sense that even though people could be pissed off or passionate about their politics, that it was not, or maybe it was always this passionate and it just didn't have a voice.
You know, it was as passionate, you know, kind of at the kind of ground level, like, you know, in Invisible Bridge, I write about what happened when Gail Sheehy went for New York Magazine. She went to a bar in Queens to talk about Watergate, and they're all like, well, Nixon should, you know, like have, you know, Ellsberg assassinated. You know, that's what a real president would do, you know. Wow. But, you know, these guys didn't have Fox News, right?
Right.
And so that largely is a media story. And it's also partially, and I don't want to be too tough on them, but it's also partially a story about the Democratic Party, you know, kind of abandoning kind of left labor wing, you know, which really kind of gave guys like that, you know, some money in the bank, you know.
Yeah.
Every time they talk about, you know, maybe we should cut Social Security, or maybe, you know, the real answer to our future is, you know, more investment in the stock market, or, you know, coal miners should learn how to code. You know, I think, you know, there's lots, obviously, that one of the reasons the books are so long is there are a lot of moving pieces to this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're in a kind of, you know, 1850s feeling situation. And, you know, I mean, ultimately, I lay the responsibility for that on, you know, the reactionaries who, you know, really are trying to create a society that's very stratified and authoritarian. And, you know, we've seen where that's gotten us. And, you know, so, you know, I write, you know, both as a historian, but also as a partisan liberal Democrat, you know, so I'm kind of inviting citizens to do something about it.
Right. Another book, I had another author on earlier this year, Kurt Anderson, in his book, Evil Geniuses, which obviously overlaps in many ways with your book. You had, you know, these sort of architects of this economic idea, the trickle-down economics. You had Milton Friedman and Arthur Laffer. And this idea that if you went to one of the positions of these, of this political view, was that you needed to crush the unions. And that was a key thing that Reagan did. And that idea, you know, when you talk about Jimmy Carter not kind of strengthening the unions or backing them in the right, you know, that was a huge kind of mistake. That was that allowed what happened to happen. It took
There was a lot of complacency when it came to that.
Yeah.
And it turns out the churches were the unions of the right wing. They could use churches basically that are kind of like infrastructure that, you know, they had their own precinct organizations, like a kind of a union local. A church is like a union local. You can kind of like get people kind of working in harness, you know, because there's a leader people trust.
Right. Well, it's always been fascinating. It's interesting that you put it that way as them being unions, because my whole life, I grew up in the South. My parents are conservative. A lot of people I knew were. And whenever you'd bring up, you know, socialized medicine or, you know, any kind of government support of anything, they would be like, we don't need that. We can depend on the churches. And it's sort of, you know, basically it's like, if you don't believe in God, you're out to, you know, you're screwed, right?
Right, right, right. That's a really good way of putting it.
This is Inside the Hive.
Back to the point a moment ago about, you know, Carter giving up on the unions, you know, when Reagan came into office, you know, the left really never kind of recovers. You know, it always plays to the center, which is a right of center that Reagan basically established. You know, by the time Clinton comes into office, he's playing
right.
on the Republicans.
Elected are so terrified of what happened in 80. I mean, the trauma of, you know, a lot of the people who became the kind of who really sailed the headwinds of neoliberal turn of the Democratic Party were people who suffered a trauma in 1980 from Reaganism. And Clinton lost his reelection fight in 1980. Remember, I talk about the Muriel Boatlift and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden lost an election. You know, Evan Bayh was the son of Birch Bayh, who, you know, was this liberal senator who lost his election.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's lots of interesting things going on in the left in the 1980s, too. I mean, there were literally how many people you might remember. I'm sure it was in Rolling Stone. There was like maybe 1 million or 2 million people protesting for a nuclear freeze. And right. Reagan takes it so seriously. It's one of the reasons he negotiates with Gorbachev. Mm. You know, we don't have a war in Central America, which Reagan desperately wanted. So, you know, I want to be fair to the left, too.
Sure. They lost, I think, the war of ideas. You know, they didn't have a distinct alternative vision.
Well, there was a lot of confusion, right? So like kind of like there was a lot of we got this far with the New Deal kind of paradigm, and suddenly the economy is in the shitter.
Yeah.
And we're losing all these elections, so it must be the New Deal paradigm. But there's almost like a tragedy to that, because as this is happening, partially because of the rise of Republicans and Democrats kind of not fighting back, you're beginning to get the stagnation and inequality, you know, that we see now, you know, happening. So in a sense, what we needed was kind of more New Deal, right? But, you know, that wasn't fashionable, right?
Right.
So, I mean, in a sense, what wasn't needed was kind of new ideas, but kind of a little more stalwartness, you know, and kind of honoring a good idea that worked, which was kind of like decent regulation, you know, decent labor protections. But, you know, a lot of people who were kind of at magazines like, you know, the Washington Monthly and the New Republic, and some of them have, you know, kind of apologized for this too. You know, it's the story Kurt Anderson tells.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, this stuff isn't cool anymore. Let's go with Jerry Brown, who says we need a balanced budget amendment, you know?
Right.
So, you know, I mean, I hate to sound like a partisan, but maybe what we need was, you know, kind of more leftiness rather than less, you know?
Right.
I don't know. You know,
yeah, well, can't know now, but I mean, Joe Biden is about to, thread, some of these needles.
Yes. And he, and, you know, Joe Biden's superpower is anything he says sounds reasonable. And, look, he's tacking to the left. I mean, the Joe Biden who makes his cameos 4 or 5 times in Reaganland is a guy who has his finger in the wind.
Right.
And, you know, even corporate America, the business roundtable, is beginning to say, look, this idea that the point of a corporation is to deliver shareholder values hasn't really worked. So they claim that they're, you know, and the funny thing is there's this funny kind of back to the future element and kind of like the Biden transition. He has this meeting with union leaders and business leaders and then emerges saying, we all agree that we need an economy that works for everyone. And it almost sounds like this kind of like, it's very 60s, but not the kind of Jerry Rubin or Tom Hayden 60s, but the kind of Lyndon Johnson 60s, where there was this kind of modus vivendi between business and labor about the idea that we needed to care about, you know, the society itself, you know, not just, you know, profits.
I think that's, yeah, and you had Charles Koch recently, right, in the journal. also, you know, trying to
a little too late for that guy. Man.
Yeah, yeah. Oh gosh, what a mess we made over the last 60 years.
Yeah, sorry.
but you know, when I was talking about that cultural narcissism, and I don't want to interpret them in ways they don't mean to be interpreted, but just thinking, you know, extrapolating on that a little bit, you know, the country, both right and left, in some ways, but you know, certainly on the right, almost by principle, kind of lost sight of this, of the public square. Right.
Yeah,
just this idea. Yeah. This sense that we're all in this together. And there's definitely that's in the air right now. And we don't know if that will materialize as a thing, because now we have this kooky fringe.
I mean, I wrote, I'm involved with In These Times magazine, a liberal magazine, left wing magazine in Chicago. I'm going to be the board chairman next year. And I wrote a cover article this year, a million years ago.
Yes.
You know, this summer, basically, about how market thinking has caused a lot of the COVID crisis we're facing. And I compared the kind of ethic of collective sacrifice that we saw during World War II to, you know, you can't even get someone to wear a mask, you know, anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, talk about narcissism,
yeah.
Right? The idea, you know, I mean, Carter was nostalgic for sacrifice. You know, I mean, he literally would say, he would talk about World War II as if it were an ideal that we should all be acting like a war is going on.
Yeah, yeah.
But now we're actually in a time in which, you know, we're facing the possibility of a moral equivalent of war.
Yeah.
This kind of society-wide, kind of mustering, you know, yeah. against this crisis that could really, you know, teach us about what happens when the government works in the interest of the people, you know, work in the interest of one another. And, you know, how, as John F. Kennedy used to say, a rising tide can indeed lift all boats. So, you know, that's, you know, we can't change the past. We can understand it, you know, but we can certainly, you know, live with our eyes open. And the lessons really do seem to be now that, you know, too much individualism, you know, brought America to a very sorry pass. And that's on us, and that's up to us to transcend.
Yeah. Well, that is, you know, where our eyes all look to 2021 with great hope. It's great to read, you know, this dense history. And when I say dense, that makes it sound like it wasn't incredibly fun to read. I mean, your book was blurbed by Stephen King, who says, compares it to reading a novel. So I certainly feel like that when I'm reading your books. And one of the reasons they were such a model for me is how can you make, you know, history have a pulse like that.
Well, when you're writing about, you know, drug binging rock stars, you have a head start. So I actually got to go back and fix some typos for the paperback, which is coming out in August. So I better move to my next task.
Oh yeah. Well, listen, it has been a great pleasure talking to you. And, we didn't even get to talk about jazz records, which is a subject that we'll save for another episode.
Okay. But next time.
One
Cheers.
Will that have much lower, ratings, but thank you for coming on the show.
Never buy a jazz record. Just go on YouTube and listen to live performances.
There you go. That you heard it here, people. All right. Have a great week and rest of year, and happy holidays. And that's our show this week. I'd like to thank historian Rick Perlstein for coming on the show. Thanks, of course, to my co-host, Emily Jane Fox, and my producer, Bob Tabador. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive. You can find those on Apple Podcasts, Radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please leave a review. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors. Please support them the way they support this podcast. And we will see you next week.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
From PRX.